Hello and welcome to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast. My name is Omer. I am the Knowledge to Action Lead with Gen Squeeze. Joining me are my colleagues Andrea Long, Senior Director of Research and Knowledge Mobilization, and Paul Kershaw, Gen Squeeze founder and UBC policy professor. Andrea, you were just saying right before we started recording that we still have the snow in Vancouver. And I was saying that we have been having a very Vancouver winter here in Ottawa. So it seems like the world is upside down, as usual.
Yeah, I don't relish your Vancouver winter. Personally, I'm not a fan of the Vancouver cold, drizzly, wet weather. I'd take Ottawa's snow, or at least your usual snow, any day over that.
Sunshine, snow, and cold. That sounds lovely compared to dampness. It's like bone chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was walking along the canal last night, and it was just sad to see that it had completely melted. Over the last week, we've been having such mild temperatures.
Do you ever skate to your shared office space?
No, I don't know how to skate. I'm technically like a first generation immigrant. So there's many things about Canadian culture that I haven't quite mastered. But my son will I think, get into that.
Well, when we come out to Ottawa next, and it's, I think, going to be in the winter, I think we need to have a Gen Squeeze team building party, which involves skating on the canal and then getting a beaver tail.
Let's do it.
Good, good, good.
Yassine will love the beaver tail.
Yassine's going to love it. Exactly. Oh, I thought he was going to love the skating.
Oh, he doesn't know skating yet, but he probably liked that too. Okay, so that's a plan. And actually, that's kind of the fact that we're looking ahead already is kind of in line with what we're talking about today. So today's discussion will be a follow-up of last week's. And once again, we don't have a hard truth to share. We're having a discussion prompted by our 10th anniversary. And so last week we outlined the Gen Squeeze story. We traced the early origins of the organization to the work that Paul was doing at UBC with the Human Early Learning Partnership. And then we worked our way to the present iteration of the organization, which we referred to as Gen Squeeze 3.0. And in that iteration, we highlighted the fact that we're foregrounding intergenerational fairness and intergenerational solidarity in making the case that the well-being of younger and future generations is something that should matter to all Canadians, including older generations. So that's kind of where we left off. And today, we want to shift to highlighting some of the achievements that we've had over the last decade, maybe talk about some of the lessons that we've learned along the way, and also talk about where we're headed as we look into the next decade. Does that seem like a good overall framing?
Let's do it.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay.
Can we say, though, happy birthday one more time? It's a big deal, 10 years. I keep going back and just seeing like, oh, when did we start on Twitter? When did we get our URL? It really was 10 years ago. And it, for me, it doesn't seem that long ago.
One of the things we had in the initial intro, I know Andrea had written that we should be happy that we've even survived to 10 years or something. I mean, she put it in a better way. But I had kind of complained that this was too modest a celebration.
Yes.
I remember earlier days in Gen Squeeze, and I was speaking with leadership from a great group called Civics. And I think Civics might have been celebrating at that time about its 7-year anniversary. And the person was saying that, oh, you know, when a group exists 7 years, you actually can be confident it will like sustain itself for quite a lot longer. And I'm like, okay. We got to get to that 7 or 10 year period so that, you know, we're like institutionalized somehow and, you know, we can exist more indefinitely. So that's why I'm excited. 10 years old.
Okay, so let's launch into it then. What, as we look back, do we see as our accomplishments, our achievements, our successes?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll kick it off, Paul, and I'm sure you have plenty to say on that subject, but in reflecting on this podcast and the previous one and in our 10 years of squeezing back, spreading out, I think the thing that really stands out to me is actually our success in simply putting generational fairness as an issue on the map for people. So that sort of hearts and minds change that, you know, we recognize that there are gaps in the way we treat generations in terms of fairness between age groups, and that is a source of concern for, I think, a growing number of people, young people in particular, but you know, I think a growing number of older folks who love those young people as well. I think in Canada, you know, prior to Jen Squeeze, the way in which we primarily had a conversation about age in this country was really about seniors, for the most part, talking about seniors, the risks they face in terms of financial vulnerability, and those sorts of things. And that's important. That remains important. I don't think anybody would want to see a senior in their life facing poverty or a risk of poverty. But now we also have, I think, to complement that important narrative, people like our Deputy Prime Minister talking about intergenerational injustices in Canada. We have media coverage, we have media outlets talking about how the economic security for younger people is declining, you know, mostly highlighted, I think, by the rising housing costs in particular. And then we have organizations like Jen Squeeze, and like, we're not only out there championing that perspective and that evidence, but we're winning awards for that work. You know, we're winning awards from the Government of Canada, from leaders in the housing sector for our efforts to mobilize knowledge around the harms caused by rising housing prices, and from academic institutions, which really underscores our, you know, credibility and the rigor we've brought to the data around generational fairness. So I think that is a big victory, just putting generational fairness out there as an issue and recognizing that we can rally people around that as a cause.
And I think that goes and speaks so directly to like the theories of change that we were talking about last time, where in order to win actual policy victory, we think we have to go through the work of shaping people's opinions, framing issues in ways that attract their hearts and their minds so that we can then set an agenda around some concrete policy changes that we then create incentives for politicians to implement because they can see that's in their electoral favor and that it's good for the country. So I think you're right, Andrew. So much of our work is about framing issues differently to transform the way we think about the status quo. And, you know, that does make me think about some of our key victories along the way. And they've come in family policy. They come in housing policy. And to some degree, also in climate policy. And we have a whole podcast episode on, you know, the $10 a day child care victory, which was key to our Jen Squeeze 1.0. You know, we had this new deal for families. $10 a day was key branding for that. If you haven't listened to that pod episode with our talented, lovely, wonderful colleague, Linnell Anderson, I encourage people to go back and listen to that one, because that 10 years of work of framing issues about why we can't leave childcare another rent or mortgage-sized payment, why it shouldn't be more than university tuition at a moment when generations raising young kids are paying down their student debt, that framing of people's beliefs and opinions then resulted in 2021 and 2022 with this historic $30 billion investment in childcare, followed by an extra $9 to $10 billion a year thereafter. And I'll just be careful to like harken back to the episode with Linnell Anderson. When I say, you know, tremendous number of groups that came together, Childcare Now, the $10 a day coalition in BC, and this important framing work that was so critical. And that excites me because we continue to do more and more of that work around other issues on housing. And I'm not sure we've had as big a breakthrough on fixing housing unaffordability, but we've got a number of other, you know, key issues that I'm looking forward to chatting about in this episode with you.
Actually, I'm wondering on the childcare victory, like, how does that feel? Because that's a very concrete frame. It's like, okay, we're really fighting for this $10 a day goal. And then how do you feel when the government comes out and says, hey, we're introducing this $10 a day policy? What do you feel that morning?
Woohoo, baby! Literally like that. Yeah, I think we feel really darn excited that, one, the work from the past is starting to pay off, and in like really consequential terms. I think in a context where there's just so much inflation and so many cost of living pressures, the investment in $10 a day childcare right now is actually one of the few initiatives that's restoring purchasing power to younger Canadians. And, you know, I think it's just such a key pillar in having a country that works for all generations. So it's just like, woohoo. And then, though, it makes me feel optimistic to the things that Andrea was highlighting at the top of, like, what have we achieved? Because we're doing some of that similar work, trying to put this norm of intergenerational fairness on the policy agenda, trying to win hearts and minds to see that housing and housing unaffordability, family unaffordability, climate change risk, these are symptoms of the underlying disease of intergenerational fairness. And I think it's so critical that we win that, and why Andrea's observation about where we've had some influence is important. And then it paves the way to, you know, some of the incremental housing victories that we've achieved. And, you know, I want to send it back to Andrea, but maybe while I'm on the housing piece, you know, this is an era that was sort of pre-Andrea. So, like, I'll remind people, when 2017, when we finally came up with a national housing strategy in this country after decades of not having one, the first two drafts of that national strategy did not identify young adults as being vulnerable in the housing market. And as a result, because they were not included in the group of vulnerable constituencies, they weren't going to be eligible for many of the billions of dollars that national housing strategy was going to make available. And it was Jen Squeeze that was leading both in public and in the halls of power, meeting with MPs, literally trying to get the MPs response, you know, sitting next to the minister responsible, say, you've got to remind him that young adults need to be in this list. And it was only after in the last draft that we finally eked it in to get young adults into that. But that's so critical for making the national housing strategy better. And we got that in, and I'm really delighted about that. There's more work to continue to make it, you know, have even greater impact for all young adults. But you see then our efforts to, you know, Jen Squeeze worked with the city of Vancouver to implement the first ever tax on empty homes. So that we say housing has got to be for homes first, not, you know, investment strategies where people keep these units empty. And then that started to spread in, you know, throughout BC and into Ontario. We've worked to protect specifically in Ontario. You know, prior to 2019 and some of our work there was like limitless rent increases that were permissible. That was something that with the Wynn government in particular, we changed. Retrospectively, that change has remained. Unfortunately, prospectively going forward, the new government has switched on that front, but it's still a big change that we're proud of retrospectively. And we've really, I think, helped to resist the kind of NIMBYism that gets in the way of building the rental housing that is so desperately needed by more and more young people who are locked out of home ownership. We can point to many specific rental development projects in cities across the country that we've contributed. That's like concrete achievements on the ground, achieved by influencing the framing, building some coalitions, engaging directly with decision makers, showing them how their incentives actually are in their favor to act on the evidence, and then change, sometimes too incrementally, comes.
I think what Paul said has offered a nice sort of contrast almost in two different ways in which Jen Squeeze has had real impact on the ground. One is the obvious, maybe the more obvious, policy victories, things like $10 J childcare or some of the housing policy changes that we've seen, or our role in contributing to building a legal case for why pricing pollution should be considered constitutional, which was also a big win for our organization. And we could talk more about that too. But I think the other piece that you're really flagging here, Paul, is that it's also important to make contributions to changing the institutions and structures within which policies are created, because those institutions will respond to their own set of, you know, pressures and motivations and inertia in many cases. And when you change some of those structures, you can really pave the way for then other policy changes to come. So I think your example of getting young adults referenced in the National Housing Strategy is a really good example of that. That, you know, it wasn't a matter of saying, here's the specific policy we need to address on young folks' housing, but we need to just recognize that young people are getting creamed in the housing market. They're disproportionately struggling with rising costs for purchasing a home and then rising rents that are pulled along behind housing prices. So that was an important sort of structural change that I think is a really good example of the kind of maybe more behind the scenes work that Jen Squeeze is doing that can have a tangible impact on the ground. The other one I wanted to point to that I think fits into that category, which may sound to some like a little inside baseball, is that we managed to get at the federal level the first age accounting in government budgeting processes. So, you know, we're always articulating the case for why we need to monitor age distributions in government spending and what the intergenerational impacts are of that distribution. You can't do that if governments actually are not in fact reporting on how spending breaks down by age. So, you know, again, I think that's more behind the curtain kind of work that we've been doing, but we were able to get the federal government to shift in that direction and adopt an age accounting process. Now, sadly, the age accounting approach they use isn't ideal. It's got some flaws, so we still have work to do there. And of course, we need provinces to catch up to that model because no province is really taking on that challenge as of yet. But still, I think, again, that's the kind of like sort of structural or institutional change that's really important. And that's a big part of what we're doing.
I wonder, Andrew, if you could just talk about that a little bit more, with, you know, putting on your former hat on. So you used to be a bureaucrat in the Public Health Agency of Canada, leading policy around, you know, this, what the social determinants have, and so responsible for preparing paperwork that often would go to Treasury submissions with regards to, you know, budget asks. And is it not the case that after we worked with the federal government to have them start bringing this age lens to how spending was unfolding, that that worked its way into the forms that talented bureaucrats needed to complete when making budget requests of Treasury?
Yeah, that's a good point. So the very back end of the public process that we see when governments release their budgets is the flurry of activity that our dedicated public service employees are doing to propose policy directions and to talk about who's going to benefit or who might be harmed by those policy directions. And that paperwork, as you know, as you said, Paul, like it has a whole bunch of considerations around where the benefits might be directed or where the potential risks might be directed. And yeah, the inclusion of considerations around age is an important piece there. And I think, again, like really that addition of the of those considerations is what I think helped people start thinking not just about age as a consideration for risks to seniors, but age as a consideration for the deteriorating well-being of young people and think about, factor that into their analysis and consideration of where, you know, quite a diverse range of policies could have age implications, whether it's employment policy or income supports offered by governments, or obviously things like childcare and education, which are disproportionately going to younger age groups anyway. So yeah, that's a, it's a really, although that is a, you know, sort of behind the scenes kind of change, it does have real impact, it does filter through with real impact on what gets put forward.
But it gets at why we think it's so important to do systems change and why we think about sometimes our budget recommendations. For those who've been with Gen Squeeze for some time, they'll go and they'll see that we have routine budget recommendations some of the time, which are very granular and look boring. And they're not nearly as sexy as saying the housing system's dysfunctional and let's go tax that easy villain over there, or let's go, you know, critique what that nasty developer's doing over there. That can sell headlines easily. Asking people to do an age accounting of government budgets or to be thinking about how are we measuring inflation accurately, et cetera. Those things are get nerdy and in the weeds, but they're so critical. And just think, in the National Housing Strategy, they did have one age group in the first two drafts that was integrated in the vulnerable groups, and it was seniors. And we know there are some seniors who are very vulnerable in our housing system, but the data are also absolutely beyond contestation that 80% of retirees, 75-80% of retirees are homeowners and have been especially likely to have benefited from the dramatic wealth accumulation that skyrocketing home prices have produced. And yet the history of thinking about age in the institution of the federal government had led them to think, oh, older folks are disproportionately vulnerable, when the data actually no longer supported that. And so that's why our trying to bring this age lens into the machinations of government planning are so critical.
Okay, so we've already started chatting about tactics. I'm wondering, you know, if it would be worthwhile to talk a little bit about our general theory of change. And then you've already sort of, both of you have sort of highlighted the behind the curtain or behind the scenes kind of change. And I'm wondering if we could outline some of that, what that sort of means. But prior to that, let me kind of frame it as a general question. So we, Gen Squeeze has a specific theory of change. The idea that we use is that politics responds to those who organize and show up. So our power to influence political decisions grows with the size of our network. And I'm wondering, after 10 years of testing this theory, what sorts of conclusions are we able to draw?
That's a big, deep question. And it has me thinking about, you know, the next 10 years, not just the last 10 years. So as a reminder, the punchline of our theory of change is that politics responds to those who organize and show up. But it begs the question, what does it mean to show up and organize? And for that, Jen Squeeze says, hey, we're going to make meaning of the evidence in light of people's values to shape their opinion, frame beliefs about problems and solutions in order to set a more concrete policy agenda around which we'll build a coalition. And then we're going to mobilize all of that evidence, those values, the opinions, the people power to change the incentives to which politics responds. And I think, I know in Jen Squeeze 1.0, and especially 2.0 with my lovely, talented colleague, Eric Swanson, we had a vision that the coalition building was going to be what I guess I could say a more successful part of what we do. We talked about, you know, imagine when Jen Squeeze is 10 years old, we'll have 100,000 people associated with us. And spoiler alert, we only have 37,000. And yet I wonder if Umair, as you've joined us and you're so key in shaping our Jen Squeeze 3.0 version, you're like, well, what does that mean for how we deploy people and the degree to which we're not just suit up in the halls of power, but we're asking others to spread out with us, to use their voices to bring information and evidence and calls to action directly to their decision makers. Here's what I know with certainty. Before building Jen Squeeze, when I was just had a PhD in some good evidence and went and met with decision makers. There's only so much evidence that an academic with a whole bunch of hubris thinking he has the answers can have in terms of influence on our decision makers. You know, go and knock on a premier's door or a deputy minister's door and what have you and say, hey, there's a gap between what you're doing, what the evidence says we should be doing. I can show you the gap and magically you're going to respond to me. What a bunch of hubris. But when we created Jen Squeeze and started to have thousands and then tens of thousands of people who are part of our network, I can't tell you how much more influential that makes us when we do go as a team into the halls of power federally and provincially, because now they're not just responding to evidence in an academic, now they feel like they're engaging with a constituency. And that they can make the claim that we are doing right by that constituency. That constituency is asking us for this. And that augments our power just thousands fold. Have we been as successful as a group getting thousands and thousands to join us in letter writing or signing a petition or going and taking meetings with decision makers? Not as much as we might have assumed in Jen Squeeze 2.0 around 2015. And that invites important questions about how we make the best use of our time going forward in Jen Squeeze 3.0. But I am absolutely certain that as we've, you know, launched our latest website for Jen Squeeze 3.0, and it talks about how to get involved, you know, that asking people to get informed, asking people to spread the word, attract others to join us to grow our network, which grows our influence in the world of politics, remains critical. And then there's some secret sauce that I'd love to figure out how to do better so that at moments we do have not only our effectiveness in the halls of power, bringing evidence directly with our credentials that can't be discounted, but also have others use their voice and sharing their experiential expertise and their political influence directly. I still think there's that sweet spot that we wish to achieve more of going forward.
Yeah, so there's so many things you could say in response to that question, Umair. It's a really big one and a really important one. I guess it kind of takes me back to something Paul said in our first part of our discussion about our 10-year anniversary, in that he called our current focus in Jen Squeeze or described us as being rebels with a cause. And I think that's an important characterization. And I think it really speaks to the early parts of the theory of change that you pointed to, Umair, and that Paul has articulated around the framing, the shaping opinion. And you know, we've talked about how those really played into our accomplishments. And I think, you know, that being a rebel with a cause piece is really a critical part of what Jen Squeeze is all about, because we are in the business of challenging the status quo. You know, the reason we need a big coalition is because we're trying to actually like push people towards thinking differently about some of the issues that we face. We're trying to push people to take common sort of cultural beliefs, for example, that seniors are more likely to be poor. That's still something I think that's really deeply ingrained in the hearts and minds of Canadians, even though the data and the facts tell us repeatedly that it's not accurate. You're much more likely to see poverty in other age groups than seniors. Seniors are in fact least likely to have lower incomes. So we're, you know, a big part of our work around like framing and trying to engage with people's opinions and values and actually pose different ways of thinking about the issues facing us is where our successes have been grounded. Like that, I think, is the starting point for how we've turned our theory of change into real concrete victories for younger folks and for Canadians overall in terms of getting things like affordable national childcare, in terms of resisting having short-term rentals, and in terms of trying to challenge the climate crisis that's going to disproportionately create risks for younger people. So I think in that respect, I guess I'm wanting to focus on the front end of that theory of change, because I actually think there's ample evidence in what we've done over 10 years to say we should really stick with that approach. Like, I think there's real merit in how we've thought about the process of creating change when you're trying to work at sort of these broad systems levels. It's not a one-off or one-step process. It takes time, and it takes building that, you know, different sense of what the issues are and building people's participation in the process.
And if I could riff off that right now, Andrea, I think that let's pick up your last theme around the climate change issues on which we work. And so there are many other groups that have been working harder and actually just amazingly, even way better than Jen Squeeze on environmental issues. And yet, I think one thing we're really proud of at Jen Squeeze is as the federal pricing pollution legislation was being called into question in the courts, we were the kind of organization that had was able to be nimble and the ability to engage other organizations to say, this is a critical moment that we have to defend the constitutionality of pricing pollution, both in the courts and in the media. And so while Jen Squeeze hasn't always been as effective as I would have liked to have like lit a fire under our tens of thousands of people to like, write a letter now to your MP, we were able to very, very quickly, and with no internal dollars to do this initially, bring together children's rights groups, public health groups, youth engagement groups, and say, we are going to be an intergenerational climate coalition that's going to go into the courts in Saskatchewan, go into the courts in Ontario, and eventually go into the Supreme Court of Canada and say, we have to price pollution, because if we fail to, well, then we literally are committing an intergenerational injustice to younger people today and those who follow, because they will be paying the unpaid bills for our climate debt. And so that's an example, I think, the kind of coalition building we are actually quite nimble and effective at. I think right now our work on trying to encourage StatsCan to improve the way that it measures housing inflation, like we nimbly pull together a mini coalition with colleagues at the Conference Board of Canada and the Business Council of BC on this very non-sexy issue. I think about, you know, our efforts to poke the status quo about the problems with the homeownership tax shelter and how we bring together, like, you know, a coalition of scholarly colleagues and housing organizations that work in the not-for-profit space and, you know, organizations that work on tax policy and social justice and bring them together to be like a mini coalition that we're managing to do. And it makes a difference then for winning change or defending changes that have recently been made.
So you've suggested that there is a sense of disappointment, perhaps, that we're not able to translate the size of our network into things like mass petition campaigns or letter writing sort of efforts. And that's interesting to me as someone who does that kind of work professionally as an activist. And I mean, I've done that for a very long time, because there's something, I wonder if our listeners would agree, I wonder if you would agree, like, there's something about when one does write a letter or does sign a petition, there's a kind of surreal quality to it. You know, you're like, you're doing it, you're going through the motions, and you kind of have to psych yourself up to even believe that this is worthwhile. Because if this is all it would take, then I don't know how many millions of letters have been written about solving climate change, for instance, or any of the other host of problems that we face. And, you know, I don't want to suggest that writing letters is completely a waste of time.
Please don't, because I do think it matters still.
No, and it is part of the kind of repertoire of what we use as activists and as organizers. But I'm just trying to say, like, I think we have to be sober about what those sorts of tactics ultimately translate into, and perhaps also why people, you know, after this barrage of this internet-based activism where we're just told, hey, sign another petition, write another letter, send another tweet, where people are kind of like, well, maybe, you know, maybe that's not going to solve it. And I actually find it empowering to hear that the fact that we have these tens of thousands of people or several tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Don't downplay. It's 37,000. It's not the 100K I expected, but it's not nothing.
It's more than 37,000. I haven't given you the updated numbers recently. So,
woohoo, baby.
But in any case, yeah, I think the idea that having this network and that being a means to getting access into the halls of power and to government officials and policymakers, being able to have some influence. I mean, I think that that's actually seems to me like a more empowered way to kind of carry on the kind of work we do than the tactics that we would use in letter writing or petitions or protests or that kind of thing. Again, not to say that those are completely invalid and that we won't be using those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, it has, I mean, it's now provoked a whole bunch of conversations for me, and I just can't wait for some of our strategic planning conversations we're going to have offline. But I'll say one thing, and then I want to actually ask Andrea, because it reminds me of conversations we've been having. So there's no doubt that, you know, clicktivism isn't going to, the revolution's not going to be clicked. Clicktivism is not going to win the day on its own. I think that there's something powerful about the Gen Squeeze model. What is making us unique is that we are this think and change tank. We are this university community collaboration. And there's something about having our lab in the halls of the academy, one of the most prestigious intellectual institutions in the country. And then, you know, institutionally wedded together, formally joined in collaboration with the charitable part of Gen Squeeze that welcomes tens of thousands of people to be part of our knowledge mobilization team, whether they're giving us their influence by growing the size of our network or they are sometimes bringing their ideas directly to decision makers. I think that that is part of the secret of our success when we win sometimes. And gosh, we know we want to win more often. But I wonder if, Andrea, you could pick up the theme that's so important for our Gen Squeeze 3.0, where we actually now articulate formally that we're in the business of rejuvenating democracy. And we've never said that before in Gen Squeeze. That wasn't a 1.0 message. That wasn't a Gen Squeeze 2.0 message. That is actually emerging as we've been thinking about what are we doing here now 10 years later? And I wonder if, Andrea, what do you think of Umair's points about, you know, typical strategies about exercising democratic muscles with letter writing and petitions? Those tools may still matter as tools, but what do we think we're doing right now when we make this quite audacious claim that we're partly in the business of rejuvenating democracy? Actually, I put that question to both of you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Umair probably has lots to say on that too. well, I guess let me just start by saying, like, I think the initial question Umair raised about tactics, which is really what we're talking about here, is, I mean, I guess I kind of think the reason why, you know, petition and letter writing, I think for a work like ours, you know, has value, but, you know, maybe can only be applied in certain circumstances, is that I think those letters and the petitions without the framing, I think, don't deliver the value that we need to have in terms of our rebel with a cause sort of disruption agenda. So I don't think it's enough to tell politicians, you need to fix housing affordability, for example, if we're not backing that up with some, you know, thoughtful dialogue about the kinds of solutions that we think are important. And we need to frame those solutions, I think, in a way that get past the usual suspects of, well, let's just build more houses. You know, there's more going on than that, which I think is why, you know, the first step in proposing meaningful solutions has to be the framing of the problem in the right way, so that we can actually arrive at solutions that get to that problem. I think that's why Gen Squeeze has, you know, really contributed a lot to the housing conversation by pointing to this double-edged sword that the housing market has been. Yes, it's crushed affordability for many young people. It's also grown massive wealth for many homeowners. And I think, you know, we've been, along with others, have really sort of inserted that perspective into the conversation. And that, it's that, I think, kind of observation that has to drive, you know, the sort of clicktivism type tools. And I think it's just harder to do when you're making that challenging claim that resists the way maybe many people think about the problem and the solutions. So that's, I just wanted to say that to start, but the Rejuvenating Democracy, I think, is a really interesting segue, Paul. And I mean, you're right. I think it's not something, to my understanding, I haven't been here for the whole 10 years with Jen Squeeze, but you know, that's not been a lens we've really applied to our work. But I think increasingly, we've really come to see almost everything we do through that sort of perspective. I think that's really at the core of our idea of coalition building, that we want to, you know, inform, equip, and engage people in the kinds of conversations that we want to have about the policies we want and like the future we want, the intergenerationally just future that we want Canada to head towards. So I think it's really become a connecting thread between our work overall. And it's, I think, a really timely one, given that we're seeing, you know, the last Ontario provincial election had the lowest voter turnout ever. Everyone is seeing the incivility in public and political dialogue that, you know, I think is on the rise, you know, thanks in part to some of the trends maybe that have emerged in our neighbors to the south. But I think we have to take some responsibility for our own dialogue here, too. So we're seeing these trends, I think, that are making the public and political space perhaps like making people feel disillusioned about the value of participating in that. And I think what we're trying to say to folks is, you may feel disillusioned. We may be right there with you in terms of the speed at which we're seeing the changes that we want to happen actually be put into place. But we can't opt out. Opting out is never going to be a winning tactic because we can't on our own make the sorts of systemic changes that we need to make Canada work for all generations. That you might think that's a good thing. You might think that's a bad thing. But it is the case. We need governments in part and other institutions who have the levers to shape our systems and our policies to help us make those changes. So, you know, opting out is not going to be the path to actually building a generationally fair Canada.
Yeah, I think those are really great points. And when it comes to rejuvenating democracy, I'm wondering, you know, I don't know if I have an answer for Paul's question. And I wonder if I can ask another question.
That's cheating, but okay.
And maybe not one that can be answered right away. And maybe it's a question to our audience as well and to our broader network. So in thinking about rejuvenating democracy, you know, how do we think about that internally and with respect to our own work? So we're saying that a very important mechanism for us to create change has been, you know, leaning on the size of our network as a way to push on the doors of the halls of power and being able to say, well, look, we represent a constituency of people who you should be concerned about. And we can say with evidence that these are their interests and these are the ways that we can try to address them. Now, my question would be, like, how do we hold ourselves accountable to that constituency? So I think that's a kind of question. And maybe we can sort of think about that. But we also nearing the end of our discussion, and maybe if you wanted to attempt to answer that question, perhaps you can. But I also want to ask the question of like, okay, so looking ahead, what are we looking at in the next 10 years?
Well, I do want to engage a little bit with your question there. So at the heart of Jen Squeeze, when we were forming it, especially going into Jen Squeeze 2.0, and we were becoming more of an organization with its board and its governance structures and whatnot, one of the driving principles for our work was to shape and be shaped by. So we're going to shape people's opinions and frame their beliefs and engage their values and then be shaped by them. And I think there's lots of room for us to continue to improve, to be shaped by our constituencies. I mean, we've had, you know, we often invite our constituency members to engage with us, to respond to surveys, telling us what they think is important. We've done that multiple times as part of our work. Don't forget also that the lab is deeply focused on the evidence that is, you know, coming up about what's happening to younger Canadians and what's happening with intergenerational fairness more generally. So we have our constituency giving us feedback. We're also looking at the data directly. I think our commitment to rejuvenating democracy is more than though just marshaling the power that comes with a big constituency. I actually think it's recognizing that the status quo sustains itself through a range of cultural norms that make the status quo stronger. And one of the things that makes the status quo stronger is if we convince people that the world of politics is corrupt or that it can't make a difference or that it doesn't matter to us. Because if that's what we can convince, if that's what the status quo is able to convince more and more people of, then we leave individuals unable to fix these big problems from which they cannot solve them alone. Systemic problems can't be solved by individuals changing their behavior. We have to change the rules of the system. And the only way you change those rules is by changing public policy through the world of politics, which is why we have to be in the business right now of convincing people that, yes, there's good reason to be feeling disillusioned, as Andrea said, with the world of politics and the state of our democracy. But we've got to model something that's different than buying into that disillusionment. We have to be that greater fool who thinks it can be changed. So we're like that, you know, now I'll transition to like where we are as, you know, in the next 10 years. I want to go with Andrea's reminder that we think we're this, you know, the rebel with a cause right now, the cause of generational fairness. I said last time that in Gen Squeeze 1.0, we were like more like a captain with a good plan, the New Deal for Families. And then Gen Squeeze 2.0, we were like the defender. We were defending a younger demographic getting creamed by low earnings, higher costs, and their hard work not paying off. And now, though, I think, you know, we're the rebel with the cause of generational fairness, because after a decade, we see that, yes, we need a society that has order, but because without order, there's going to be chaos. But when order is left unchallenged or unquestioned for too long, it risks complacency. And with that complacency comes harm, especially for those who follow. And I think that right now, Gen Squeeze knows this more than many organizations. And we're seeking a kind of creative disruption of the status quo, driven by a kind of idealism and realism about the vision for a better way. So we're not just tearing down a problem. We are absolutely pointing the way to solutions. That's why when you come to gensqueeze.ca and you'll see generational fairness, and the first thing there is solutions. Solutions for housing, for climate, for families, for healthcare, where we're moving into more these days, for generational fairness, so that we can all accept the call to be, what I love this new book title that I've been reading lately, a good ancestor. Abiding by the generational golden rule, planning for all ages, being good stewards. And so, you know, I think the next 10 years, as we're rejuvenating democracy, it will still have us defending younger generations from the harm of our dysfunctional systems, busting myths that they're lazy and whiny and entitled. But ultimately, I think we learned from Gen Squeeze 2.0 that younger folks don't need defending. They need help breaking the status quo, which is leaving them a lousy legacy. And so I look ahead in the next decade, and I'm hopeful, because we're now also more actively recruiting older Canadians who are worried about their legacy. We are in the business of recruiting, I would dare I say, grandmothers in particular, so they can help us disrupt what is dysfunctional in Canada, so that we will build this nation that works for all generations. And that's a great thing for Gen Squeeze as a rebel with a cause to be striving for, because our progress is going to mean Canadians will be able to afford a home and benefit from the upgrades in our lives that come with ensuring climate change doesn't drive global temperatures above 1.5 degrees, and ensuring that all families have enough time and money to enjoy life while raising their kids. A healthcare system that's resilient, because we invest where health begins. I think if we do all that, then we'll get to why Gen Squeeze emphasizes so much the need to budget for all generations and to rejuvenate democracy, so that we're going to turn the evidence into action and really preserve what's so sacred for people. A healthy childhood, a healthy home, a healthy planet. That's the next decade.